By most measures, the 44-year experiment in an all-voluntary military force has been a success. But like stocks, past performance doesn't guarantee the future. In fact, the all-volunteer force is showing serious strains with what's causing them and some possible ways forward. Catherine Kidder, a fellow at the Center for a New American Security, and Amy Schaefer, a research associate for the Military Veterans and Society program there. Great to have you both in studio.
Thanks for having us.
Let's start before the study that you've actually done, and that is with former Defense Secretary Ash Carter's Force of the Future initiative. You found that maybe didn't quite go far enough or didn't get enough time to really get the ball rolling, and that was the kickoff to what you decided to take a deep look at.
Right. So I think the Force of the Future initiatives had a lot of really fantastic ideas and embedded within them. But what we saw was a lot of pushback both from Congress and the military services about the effect that these reforms might have on readiness. And maybe there was a need to better make the case as to why these reforms were necessary.
That topic of readiness, though, is debated itself. I've heard military analysts say, well, readiness is overrated. If China decided to invade, we'd know a year ahead of time and we could get ready. So how did what Ash Carter was proposing affect readiness?
Well, as we looked at, the current budget constraints and end strength requirements, Congress was really reckoning with reconciling these dual requests for more forces and getting them to equipping them to the readiness levels that we would need to face a conflict, while simultaneously balancing requests to increase graduate education opportunities or allow for a little more work-life balance or work-family balance for members of the services. And so the conflicting requests between readiness and preparedness for war and also building into the intellectual capital in the military seemed a little misplaced to some members of Congress.
Sure. And Amy, it sounds like the whole thing over the decades has gotten both complicated and expensive.
Absolutely. I think we've seen a huge spike in the cost of military personnel, while over time we've also seen the number of military personnel decrease. So there's also a question of sustainability with the way that we currently staff and fund the all-volunteer force.
Would you say that maybe the apex of the whole thing was Operation Desert Storm, when we had 500,000 troops in one place and, wow, 6 days or whatever it was all over. Was that the high point for this force, do you think?
It was a different type of conflict, and there is a way to demonstrate overwhelming force. The way that the all-volunteer forces had to perform in this more low-intensity conflict and counterinsurgency over the last 15 years required a bit more flexibility and ingenuity within individual service members in a way that perhaps maybe the Gulf War did not.
So that was really the last, for lack of a better term, the last World War II style approach that maybe the military had taken.
Absolutely.
Let's get to the AVF 4.0. That is your report on the future of the all-volunteer force. First of all, what were you trying to do and how did you go about it?
We looked at this through an evolutionary approach. Through the AVF 1.0 is kind of what came out of the first era after the draft. And that took us through the Gulf War period. We have the AVF 2.0, which took us through the end of the Cold War, post-Cold War, into the first Gulf War. The AVF 3.0 is what we took to Iraq and Afghanistan over these last 15 years. And so what we are trying to do is to present a vision for where the future of the all-volunteer force may go.
So that 3.0 kind of had elements of what might be the future and what was also the past. It was a fairly big, a couple of 100,000 maybe, banging down in Baghdad there. But they also had the door-to-door, breakdown doors and hallways type of insurgency warfare all blended in at once.
Yes, that's correct.
There's so many aspects to this, cost and how do they recruit and the type of people there. We've had a lot of social experimentation that has turned into policy in terms of who can serve openly over the last number of years. What do you think the AVF 4.0 should look like?
Well, I think personally, I would love to see more diversity in the force going forward. I think that we have recruiters who have to work very hard in order to meet their recruiting targets, but what that's led to is we see both a family history of service and then also some geographic isolation from where the force comes from that may be separating the military from society at large.
We're speaking with Catherine Kidder. She's a fellow at the Center for a New American Security, and Amy Schaefer, a research associate for the Military Veterans and Society program there. And that idea of diversity, then, you don't necessarily mean racial diversity or gender diversity and all of those things, but economic and geographic diversity.
Absolutely. I think diversity on a number of measures is a good thing. We get diversity of thought within the force. It gives us a broader base to recruit from in the future. And it really involves all Americans in the efforts that we see when we are deploying the all-volunteer force repeatedly over a number of years and we see that strain.
And Kate, can that also contribute to lethality? Because isn't that really the ultimate measure of the force?
Yes. So at the end of the day, this is about talent management and about having the most effective fighting force in the world. And what we would argue is that diversity leads to a greater talent pool, that we need to make sure that we're pulling from all corners and all experiences from the nation in order to ensure that we have the best and most qualified service members fighting at the front lines and protecting the nation.
And what do you see as the composition versus soldiers and those that are in the support functions and cybersecurity? I mean, if you don't need 500,000 people all with rifles in their hands charging at one spot, maybe you need 300 or 10,000. And then there's all this tail of support and logistics and communications and cybersecurity and all of that. What would the force composition look like?
Well, I think the tooth-to-tail ratio is a really interesting thing to look at as part of sort of the AVF 4.0. Do we really need to maintain the same physical standards across the force if we have people who we know are never going to sort of deploy to the front lines, as was common in these previous combat arms warfare conflict?
It also raises questions on what is incentivized in a career path and an experience. So how do we make sure that we have the best logisticians at the same time that we have the best operators? Because that is part of our comparative advantage in fighting across the world. And also gives way to some of these more intellectual capital thoughts. So how do you build that throughout the force through incentivizing things like education, training, beyond just operational experience?
So the pale child that stayed inside and played with video games could be just as lethal, in a sense, flying a drone from a control center or launching a cyber attack, as the former football player is in busting down a door and carrying a rifle.
Part of the challenge will be figuring out how to maintain standards that not necessarily that are leading to more lethality, but in earning bona fides in leading troops, right? So figuring out what the appropriate standards are in maintaining the culture of the military as well.
And of course, for Congress, they can easily decide on policy, but what's tougher is how to pay for all of this. And it has gotten expensive. I think it was former Secretary Bob Gates said that healthcare costs alone, he said his phrase was eating us alive. They haven't really addressed that except around the edges. And then there's the infrastructure costs for the smaller force that were built for the bigger one. So what do you see ahead for how to pay for the volunteer force as you envision it?
I think that's a really tricky question. And one of the ways that our program likes to approach it is whether or not this is just the cost that we have to accept for having an all-volunteer force that's moved away from the conscription era. And so I think that there are potentially areas where we could look at trimming costs, but you never want to see that happen on the backs of the people who choose to serve or military families.
And the question is a good one as well, as President Trump has put forth his new budget where we see exponential growth in military budgets. If Congress does approve this larger budget for the Defense Department, the question will be, how do you spend that wisely?
And three of the big issues that always affect the military are, in no particular order, recruitment, financial management, and procurement. And the last two are kind of related. And so, Amy, tell us about recruiting as you see it to help this force of the future.
So I think we really need to look at building a recruiting model that pulls in a wider swath of people, because that's going to ensure that we have sustainability over time. One of the things that we've seen is that as the force has maintained sort of around 0.4% of the population with active duty, there are less people who are exposed to military service and less people who are interested in it. So we're seeing less applications to join the enlisted ranks. We're seeing less people coming through maybe ROTC and the Ivy League schools. And that can have a steamroll effect and leading to fewer people even considering military service. And so looking at how the AVF 4.0 can reach a broader part of society so that we ensure that going forward, there's no need to look at any alternatives to drum up interest.
And not to put it crassly, but we need more blue state participation in the whole thing.
Absolutely. We definitely see that more people are coming from the South and from the Midwest than anywhere else in the country. They're actually overrepresented if you look at the number of 18 to 24 year olds in each state. And so I think looking at how we can better target maybe some of the urban centers or even the Northeast would be a huge asset to the all-volunteer force.
And did you look at some of the efficiencies that could be gained through better financial management? They have lots of improper payments, a couple hundred billion dollars every year or so, and also in procurement, where those tend to run out of control.
Yeah, so we've done a lot of thinking about this as well. On the financial management side of the House, there have been calls from Congress for the Department of Defense to reach auditability for over 20 years at this point. We still haven't reached that point. And in an era of big data and software analytics that could get us in that direction, it is that should be a target that we have in the near future in order to know where the money is going. And it may be the case that it is all going to the appropriate place, but the fact of the matter is we couldn't answer that question today.
And final question, do you think the military leadership in place now understands that some changes are needed?
I think that they do. They want the best fighting force in the world, and they want to make sure that everyone coming through the door is capable of pursuing our nation's interests.
Catherine Kidder is a fellow at the Center for a New American Security, and Amy Schaefer, a research associate for the Military Veterans and Society program there. Thank you both so much.
Thanks for having us.
We'll post a link to their study and to this interview at federalnewsradio.com/federaldrive.